This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
I'm Brian Felsen. I'm president of CD Baby and Book Baby. Book Baby, it takes your document and converts it. We convert it and format it into all the different formats so it looks good on all the devices. Then we distribute to all the online retail stores, and we pay out 100% of the profits to the author. Today, content creators have to look professional. Distribution is no longer the problem nowadays. Now the problem is how to get noticed. There's a lot of content out there. So readers browse, linger, and buy based on first impression. So I'm going to talk about 7 tips to help you get your website and your book cover to look good. First is to have a streamlined purpose. This is an example of a website, and is it about an author, which is at top, or is it about the book? And the one helpful tip is really just assume that your reader is drunk or tired or distracted. Whereas this website, on the other hand, is very, very clear. You got the title, Surviving Her. It's also written down there, Surviving Her, in case you missed it the first time. It's got a little description, a breakup guide for cowards, and it's clearly a book site. Very streamlined and easy. Here's a book cover that we did, book design. It's, what is it about? You've got cameras, you've got pictures, okay. Oh, look at top. It's about Photoshop elements. But wait, what's in it for me? Why should I care? Oh, it's for first-time users. Great, I want to buy that book. Second tip, make your branding consistent and authentic. If you're making a series, they should all look consistent. So if somebody buys one, they go back and they say, oh, wow, I got to get a complete set of this series. The fonts, the design, the title, it's all sins. It's all together. This is a children's site, website from one of our authors, Purple Fridge. URL is called purple. The color is purple. The darn fridge in the thing is purple. It's all purple, and it's kids. And so the book matches the site, and it's all consistent. Third tip, have a strong call to action. Here's a website. Well, it's got a lot of words on it. So it says mailing list, and it says keep up, and there's some wheat, and there's some shadows, and there's even a tire hanging. And it says available, but available doesn't really mean much. A lot of things are available. Whereas this website, it says, well, mailing list. Okay, you can get on the mailing list. And then the most important call to action, buy the book. So it makes it easy. The fourth tip is to own the interaction. Facebook is great, Twitter's great, but your own website, you get your own branding, you get your own look, you get engagement, you can put on video, but most importantly, you can capture email. Email still matters. Likes, friends, followers are good. Email matters. Here's a site which is good about email. Your eye goes to the right there. You got to give a little to get a little. Well, what are you giving? You're giving free step parenting success tips. And what are you getting? Their email address, where you can send them emails, including ones that say, buy the book. Fifth tip, follow traditional design principles. No matter what's being made, iPhones or iPads or websites or book covers, whatever's made nowadays, it still pertains, the same information still pertains. You need good layout, you need good color, you need harmony. Here's a site on the right, her name in blue, Chloe Benson. And then on the cover of the book, it's the same blue. Her hair is red. On the cover of the book, it's red. The website is red. It's all consistent. It looks good. It's a good one-page author page. This is a book cover that we did. I love it. I love the harmony, the elements. I love the weighting of it, how the coins are spilling out at the bottom, and then there's a window at the top and the title at the top. I like the earth tones. And it says wooden horses, and that matches the wooden horse. Sixth tip, make sure that you're visible. Actually, make sure you have good grammar. That's even more important. But make sure that you're visible. Your book won't be necessarily seen full screen. It might be little teeny thumbnails on retailer sites, and they've got to pop out. So you got to look at it in all formats. Book Baby did the cover of my book for design. I was very happy with it. And I made sure to get proofs and test them on all devices. I tested them on iPads. I tested them on my Kindles. I tested them on little iPhones so that it would be visible and look good. And the final tip is don't go it alone. You could spend all your life futzing with technology and learning about it and working on it. But writing and marketing are really where you should be spending your time if you're an independent content creator. And if you get an author templating system, it can look good. And it's the same thing with book cover design. If you do a cover design yourself, it may come out looking like you did it yourself. But if you go with experts, they can make your book look like what you'd find in a bookstore. So the seven tips help sell your book cover, help your book cover and website sell your book. Firstly, have a streamlined purpose. Secondly, make your branding consistent and authentic. Third, have a strong and simple call to action. Fourth, own the interaction. Capture the email. Fifth, follow traditional design principles. And then there's a sixth somewhere, and don't go it alone. We're here to help. Visit our blog. Follow us on Twitter for interviews, advice, and discounts, and all kinds of good stuff. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. You know, I forgot a big part of this, which is we are giving the best Igniter by audience vote a gift certificate for O'Reilly.com. So I want you to really show your love for Brian one more time, and we'll, by audience applause. Good. Can make this hard. Okay, and I believe that our next igniter is going to be Henrik Berggren. If you could run on up here. Ooh, he's fast. Henrik is visiting us via Berlin, so we have a very international audience here. And again, please bear with us. We're still trying to get some of the format issues worked out. It'll be up in a sec. Okay, so Henrik is going to be talking about ReadMill, which is a wonderful social reading site. And please, let's hear it for Henrik.
Hey, guys. Great to be here. So I just landed from a transatlantic flight and came straight here. So be nice to me. I'm here to talk about what we're doing and what we're interested in right now. Because we really believe in this, that books have a big future. And I think 15 seconds has been long gone now. Okay, so let's try it again. So I'm the founder and CEO of a company in Berlin called ReadMill. And we're making it very, very easy for people to share highlights and notes out of e-books they're reading and kind of have that as a basis for discovery. And we've been focusing a lot over the last year on the reading experience, making a great experience for everybody that wants to read ebooks and that wants to share that with friends. We found out that people really want to highlight a lot. But what has been really hard and what we have come to realize is that selling digital content on the web is really, really simple. But as a consumer, buying it is really, really hard. There's all these kind of great systems to sell books on the web or any kind of digital content like Gumroad, Ticktail, Shopify. You can actually get set up and start selling your book on a website in just half an hour. And you can do it for free, and it's really simple. But for the buyers, for the consumers, it's hard. You have things like this where you have to fill in lots of complex forms. You have to sign up for an account. You have to enter your credit card details, all of these things that makes that process really, really complicated. And then when you actually bought something, you get presented with this page, which is, you know, all of the different formats, PDF, EPUB, Mobi, another PDF. What does this actually mean? And this is still a very, very good publisher that is doing it the right way. And then when you actually downloaded all of these things, you have to download another file, which is a README file, which goes through all of the different devices that you have. And it's a different kind of setting and different kind of way of getting the file actually onto these devices. And if you have an iPad, for example, you have to connect the device to your computer. You have to find an obscure setting in iTunes. You have to drag the file over. And here you can see it's filled with lots of different files, which you don't know what they mean. And not to even to talk about and even to mention those publishers that have their own apps. So if I want to buy a book from one publisher, I have to buy one app. And from another, I have to buy another app. That can't be the way to go. And then, of course, when you finally got the file over to your device, you get this message, do you want to self-destruct? And you don't even know what to do. So we started thinking about, you know, how could we, can we actually make this into a better experience? Can actually buying be better? Well, you know, we can't fix the part that's before the actual buying, but we can try to make it better once you've actually bought the file. And so how should it be if we think about it? Well, it should be, of course, instantly on your device of choice. It should be just there after one click or even maybe even zero clicks at any device that you want it to be. And you should also, for us, connection to the social graph is very important. So you should be able to see, you know, who of your friends are reading this book right now, who have read it in the past, and who wants to read it in the future, and what are their favorite parts. It's something that we think about a lot. And, of course, it should be accessible anywhere. So if you want to switch, if you lose your device, if you want to switch to another device, of course it should be there. And you should be able to access it from anywhere you are and whenever you want. And what we also think is very important, of what the dream scenario is more money could be flowing to the retailer to kind of skip these intermediary steps where you have lots and lots of money flowing the wrong way. And also to the publisher and author in the long run, right? I mean, if more people, more money is flowing to the retailer, we also, hopefully, more money flows also to the publisher and author, the kind of real stars in this industry. And, you know, maybe this can kind of stop the horizontalization of this industry that we're seeing right now, where everybody's doing everything, to instead let publishers really focus on what they're good at, which is publishing. And then maybe sellers can actually focus on selling and really fix that part before the buying process, so you don't have these complex form and things like that. And then last but not least, of course, let us readers stop worrying about different formats, stop worrying about technology, and get right into the thing that we really love, and that is reading. Thank you very much.
Our next person up is Andrew Brenneman. Oh, wait, Romberg? You're going to come on? Okie doke. Okay, so Andrew Romberg is from Jelly Books. Okay, so round of applause for Andrew Romberg.
So, now, hello everyone. Just hoping to wait to start. Tonight I want to talk about an experiment at Jelly Books where we try to help readers discover books as opposed to just sell them books. And in the process we broke a couple of rules, and the first of those rules is if you look at any online bookstore, it seems everyone has a search button. But if you already know the title and the author of the book, you already know what you want. You're not discovering. Think about a physical bookstore. It doesn't come with a search box either. Instead, it's all about the visual display. It's like a window out on a beautiful landscape that you want to explore. It's about the layout of covers. The second rule we broke is the one of the hard sale, that you bombard the user with text and numbers and tiny little thumbnails, really trying to convert him to buy that book. It's not about discovery. So instead, we give you a very calm interface and just covers. Because we do judge a book by its cover, you can just scroll through and explore the beautiful covers until you see something that piques your interest. Price labels. They do help you choose between seller X and seller Y. But do they help you choose between book A and book B? Probably not. So we decided to leave them away. Instead, when you click on a cover, all we give you is the title, the author, and the synopsis. And our goal is to get you to sample the book, the first 10% downloaded for later reading. Does a discovery site or a bookshop have to look like the Library of Congress, with categories and nested categories and sub-nested categories? It's almost like search again. So we left it out completely, and readers hated it. So we made a slight U-turn, and we discovered that readers really just wanted a fast way to narrow down what they're exploring. But they're very predictable, always the same genres. Ratings. Ratings are a little bit like religion, very polarized, very black and white. often not very helpful. So what did we did instead? Science, data science. Follow what people are actually doing, not what they're saying. Which books are they sampling? Which book are they sharing with others? Are they sharing before or after they're sampling, before or after they're buying? Just track what they're doing. Number six, the big dogma of retailing ebooks. Lock the reader into a walled garden with spells and chants of DRM and proprietary file formats. But if you think about discovery, sharing and recommendations are the most powerful tool, and they work best in an open and free environment. So we let users share these samples through any network, on any app, on any device. Share, free like a bird. Sticky websites. Do you really have to force the reader to come to your own website where you sit like a spider in the center of the web? Instead, we let our sample and share tools, we give them out to everybody, to authors, to writers, to journalists, to bloggers, and let readers discover everywhere, but we still track the data so we can make use of it. The next one, showrooming. Most retailers react to it like a young leopard reacts to a porcupine. Hate it. But showrooming is not really evil. Readers love it, so we do what readers want. We give them one-click access straight from the end of the sample or from within the site to Apple, to Amazon, to Barnes & Noble, but we follow them. We measure what they are buying and from whom. It's again all about the data. The days of pricing an ebook at 99 cents and using that as discovery are pretty much over. At the end, cheap is just cheap. But readers still love a deal. So we're very focused on how to do smart deals, Groupon-style deals, but without the spam. Using this discovery and what we know about readers and use them as promotions very, very selectively. Last not but least, the 10th rule we broke. We freely admitted it's an experiment, and I share with you the 7 people who helped me build and design Jellybooks. And if you want to follow how this experiment continues, follow us on Jellybooks, Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Andrew. And I'm going to try and keep this moving along so that we can get on with our evenings. David Wilk, are you? There you are. David Wilk is next. And fittingly, for the slowest Ignite ever, he's going to be talking about slow marketing, slow publishing.
Woohoo. You might wonder, what am I doing talking about slow publishing in a fast digital room? Slow publishing is a call to values, not a rejection of technology. It's not about killing the Kindle or denying digital. Slow publishing is Jidoka, automation with a human touch. Modern culture is fast. The speed of digital life makes it too easy to forget the values human communication is based on. The mindless industrial conversion of writing to digital formats is the publishing equivalent of producing and selling fast food. Digital publishing is fast. There's no print, no paper, no bind, no warehouse, no shipping, no returns. And digital definitely makes publishers faster to market. But we cannot and should not speed up the 3 core components of publishing: editorial, writing and curation, design, which is presentation, marketing, connecting books to readers. In all human languages, the words for physical objects change quickly, while the words for values change, and our core narratives change at a relatively glacial pace. Communication is a deeply human value. Slow is how humans live and breathe. Speed does kill us. Editorial is about time, thinking, reflecting, and reading, writing the books. It's about developmental line and copy editing and proofreading. Editorial includes maintaining great metadata. Design enables communicating with readers. Design is based on customer experience. Workflow is based in design. Design includes quality assurance, review output, fix mistakes, review again. Marketing connects books to readers, and marketing in a digital world takes more time than ever. Social media is a massive time sink. Markets change constantly. Books are always available, so marketing is an ongoing process. We're still at the very early stages of ebook development, and we're constantly learning how to do this better. Print books may vary in size and shape, but devices vary by form and features, so content must be adapted to various platforms that are constantly evolving. Digital publishing enables and requires a difficult, time-consuming process of re-envisioning content through design for a new environment. Trial and error is a slow process. Slow publishing is iterative and generative. This is just another example of the essential design challenge we face in digital publishing. Here's a good cover and a bad cover. The comparison demonstrates why attention matters and another reason why slow publishing is necessary. Could this happen to you? Not if you take time reviewing output. How does your book actually read on different devices and orientations? Digital publishing makes you feel like you're in Oz, except you can't go back to Kansas by clicking your heels. Slow publishing is the yellow brick road. Fast publishing cheapens the reading experience. In our world, you can lose your brand's value overnight. Readers notice everything. Our commitment to quality and content design and marketing supports all business models. Quality work is slow. Fast publishing, like fast food, only has the appearance of publishing, many calories with little nutrition. Slow creates nourishing works that last. Slow publishing creates close connections with readers, which provide long-lasting value for publishers. Thus, the essential principles of slow publishing: slow down our thinking, think about what we publish, pay attention to reader experience, honor principles and practices that have been proven to work. Which leads us to the slow ABCD. Attention to detail. Basic principles do not change. Customer experience is first and foremost. Design for every environment. And another acronym while we're at it. Let's always be real. Get real. Read to learn. Engage with your text. Actively experience ideas. Listen to customers. We know that digital changes what a book can be, but book is a meaningful concept that has long-lasting value. We need to remember, book is signal, not noise. The bad news is time flies. The good news is you're the pilot. What this means to me is we can do this. Slow publishing is up to us to implement. I'd like to acknowledge, just as the as my closing, it's mainly Carlo Petrini, who's the founder of the slow food movement, Stuart Brand, whose work has been a lifelong inspiration, and thanks to Jack Perry, Ron Martinez, and Bill Strawn for assisting me. And the Slow Publishing Manifesto is available by email. Thanks.
David, and next up is Nick Ruffalo from Airbooks.
Hello, my name is Nick Ruffalo, and I'm going to talk to you about something called live authoring. I'm not going to use a lot of words, but they all have a lot of value. So, let's make sure 15 seconds actually goes by. So let's say you have a great idea, because that's really where books start. Books start as just something that inspires you. What is the first thing you do when you get a good idea? Well, first you make a few pages. So ultimately, what you're going to do is you're going to just throw your ideas down. You're going to, you know, do some drawings, do some text, and just kind of lay it down and see how it feels. Now, let's say you take those pages and you share them with your network. So you post it on Facebook and you see how people react. Do people like your first few pages? So now you can discuss. So you can talk to your network and say, what did you think about the title? Yeah, I thought it was terrible too, but I needed to put something down. Did you not like the color of this image? And you're now starting a dialogue with your network to get better ideas for your content. You can use that information to revise your content and build something better. So now you've got 12 pages built. And you're you're seeing what people actually want. So sharing is caring, and people will respect that. So if you've put value into your, you know, if you've put time into your content, you can now reward your friends, your followers with that content, and they're getting prime stuff for free. So now, once you have that quality content, they will share it with their network. So you now have a 14, 16, 20-page book that you're sharing and generating some buzz with. So you continue this feedback loop, and it's a very nice feedback loop, and yeah, there's negative comments you're going to get, and there's positive, and you can incorporate all of it, but ultimately what you're doing is you're writing content, you're getting feedback, you're bringing that back to your original content and building more content. But now you have to stop. You've invested 2, 3, 4 weeks of your time, and you have to ask yourself, should I continue? So before you invest too much of your time, as I said, a few weeks, you take a look. Do you have a large, interested audience? Are people sharing your content? And do you have a consistent following or people commenting once and then losing all interest? Really, this decides, should you continue? Assuming that you actually have an audience, there's something there, well, you go back to that cycle. You can unshare the first few pages you have, and you can add a few more pages and throw them out to the public and say, hey, what do you think? How is this progressing? Well, you've got a final book. What now? Well, export it to every format. Why not? Put it everywhere and sell it. Then what? Then the next part is wonderful. We all get to profit. So why do you profit? Well, first off, you know, building a book is expensive. It's a time-consuming process, but you already have a network that wants your content. They want to buy that completed content, so you have a guaranteed set of users to sell. You also have exactly what they want. You've heard their feedback. If they didn't like the character with blue hair and they wanted him with green hair, you've changed that. If they didn't like the way the story was progressing, you can change that. And you can still change that in your final version, but you've listened to them. Additionally, you've crowdsourced your editing. One of the most difficult processes with a long book is really just finding all those spelling mistakes and grammar flaws. I promise you, put your text out on the internet and someone's going to find every mistake you have made. And when your network is willing to do it for free, it's great. You also have existing buzz. You've made your go or no-go call, but if you've gone, you have an existing, you know, existing marketing ecosystem out there that has already generated interest in your book. You've already got SEO going on. You've got a bank of ideas. So, you know, there's a lot of serialized content and it sells very well. So you have ideas for how to take a character further, how to do a sub-project off of an ancillary character, and all of this came from your social network and your talking. Now, this isn't just for self-publishers. Publishers can provide a great value by opening up to a larger network. Publishers can have a social network of 30, 40, 50,000 emails, of Facebook, of Twitter, of all this stuff that an author may not have. So it's really about engaging your users, creating better content, selling more content, building a community. I am Nick Ruffalo. You can contact me at nick@airbook.com. Thank you.
And I have to apologize to Nick because he wanted to do this as an interactive rap. And I said, no, that wasn't fair to have music when no one else did. Matthew Robertson is next.
Okay, guys, so I'm going to talk to you guys about building an open source EPUB 3 reader with HTML5 technology. Some of the challenges that I faced while doing that and some of the lessons learned, and then the future directions that we're going to try and take this project in the future. So, first we'll talk about my favorite subject. We'll talk about me. So my name is Matthew Robertson. I'm a web developer based out of British Columbia. I work for a company called Evident Point Software Corp. And right now, they pay me to work on an open source project, which is really cool. That open source project is called Readium. So what is Readium? Readium is a EPUB 3 viewer built in HTML5 that brings EPUB 3 in the browser. So you can use your browser to view EPUB books. Right now, we package it up as a Chromium extension. This is a screenshot of the application. And we've got support for a bunch of really cool EPUB 3 features, including MathML, Media Overlay, EPUB 3 Fixed Layout. And we got most of these features implemented and supported before iBooks. It's entirely open source. It's built on open source technology, and it's built to push forward an open standard. That's the URL for the GitHub repository right there. If anybody's interested, you can go there, check out the source code, file bugs, do anything. So, development. I decided to build Readium entirely with HTML5 technology, which was a crazy idea. We pushed the technology to its bleeding edge and sometimes a little bit beyond. Working in HTML5 is a tough thing right now. One of the reasons is you have to surrender a bit of control to the browser vendors. For example, we chose to use a brand new CSS3 feature called Regions to implement reflowable pagination. And that had been around in Chrome since version 17. But then in version 21, they decided to turn it off. And there's nothing we could do except for tell our users to go and like turn on a command line flag that would turn CSS3 regions back on. It's just sort of the way it goes when you work at the bleeding edge sometimes. It's not a great user experience, but what can you do? Some things in the EPUB 3 spec are hard. Fixed layout and reflowable, they should look the same from an end user's perspective, but from an implementation perspective, they're drastically different paradigms. And I had to do so many things twice to get them to work in both those paradigms. And some things are just hard. This is a bug report that we got in the issue tracker for Readium about Japanese typography and right-to-left pagination. And I still, I had just a few hours ago, I got to sit down with the guy that filed this bug, and we had a translator, and he explained it to me. But until I sort of got that, it wasn't happening. Another thing is dealing with EPUB creators. The EPUB 3 spec is very, very powerful, and it gives you a lot of power to do crazy things. But it turns out if you do crazy things, things are going to look crazy. I'll give you an example. So this is right from the EPUB 3 samples project. It's Moby Dick. And what the creator did was they set the line height for the font with CSS. But when the user increases the font size, the font all piles up on top of each other. Whose problem is that? Is that my problem to deal with, or is that the EPUB creator's problem to make sure it looks good before they do that? Sometimes there's more than one way to do things in the spec, but that doesn't mean that you should always do it that way. I think what we need to do as a community is come up with some best practices that are like, yeah, you can do it however you want, but if you do it like this, it's probably going to work better most of the time. That's where we've been. Let's talk about where we're going. So right now, Readium is packaged up as a Chrome extension, but it's completely written in HTML5, which means theoretically it should be able to run everywhere. Practically, this is not the case. We're using some pretty advanced... it's a good slide. We're using some pretty advanced HTML5 features that are not available in all of the browsers yet. We're trying to write polyfills that will sort of get around those issues. But I think one really good idea for Readium, and a place that it might be really at home, is with PhoneGap. So PhoneGap, if you've never heard of it, it's a way to package HTML5 code with native device code and then create an application. So we could sort of offset some problems to the native code. Another idea that we talked about is allowing EPUB creators to take their book, use the Readium Chrome and PhoneGap to package up basically an application that would be their book. But the catch is, I can't do this by myself. Readium is an open source project, and an open source project is nothing without a community. So if you guys like Readium and you like the things the places that it's going, you guys need to get involved. And even if you're not HTML5 developers, you can still get involved. There's lots of ways to get involved. You can help test the application. You can tell your friends who are developers about the application. You can help write documentation. You can just come and tell me I'm doing a good job and boost my morale, so I'll keep doing it. If you do want to get involved, those are the three URLs that you need to go to. Readium.org is the installer. GitHub.com/Readium/Readium is the source code. And Readium.github.com is the developer blog where there's documentation about how the project works. That's it.
Nice job.
Aw, that was energetic. I liked that. Okay, so Teo is going to be up next, and we're going to keep Joe up here just in case we need him. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Teo Gray.
All right, so I'm Theodore Gray from Touch Press and Wolfram Research, and tonight I'm going to talk about tools. There's two main kinds of things that I've worked on in the last couple decades. One of them is to create software applications. The other is to write books. And both of these have acted like tools, sort of going out into the world and bringing back unexpected results. So my book, The Elements, this has sold quite well in both print and as an interactive ebook. It's turned out to be a more powerful learning tool than I expected, and it's also been a tool for changing people's perceptions of what an ebook could be, which was my main goal. I thought I wrote a book for grown-ups, actually, but it turns out actually it's a children's book. I had no idea. This guy came, he wanted his arm autographed. The people who come to my book signings are kids. It's weird. But actually, what I'm going to talk about in this talk mostly is not this book, but rather the tool that made it possible. So a project that I've been working on for a long time is called Mathematica. Started working on that in 1987 with Stephen Wolfram and several others. And Mathematica is basically technical computing software. It's a tool for solving modeling situations. I designed the Mathematica user interface primarily as a place for people to play with math and computation in a free-form way. Because that's the way that I wanted to work with computational problems. And it's what I thought would be useful. So in the two decades that Mathematica has been out, we've been amazed at the scope and quality and quantity of stuff that's been coming back from people using it. Everything from, you know, important scientific advances to complex financial calculations that almost ruined the world economy, possibly. We designed Mathematica as a tool for doing technical work, but it quickly turned into a tool for publishing interactive documents as well. So in that sense, I've been working, preparing for creating the Elements app for a very long time, since 1988, in the sense of working on electronic publishing tools. And in fact, many of the pages in the Elements, all the pages, were designed and modeled and generated by Mathematica using code that I wrote for that purpose. Because there were no tools available for creating this particular kind of ebook, I had to make them myself using the tool that I had. Just a random example, I wanted to visualize radioactive decay chains in this particularly attractive way. No idea how to do that using any existing tools, so I had to create one using Mathematica. And the picture looks good because the math is right. So for some kinds of ebooks, the kinds that my new company, Touch Press, publishes, this sort of high-style visual look is the right thing. And we use Mathematica in some aspects of the production of these books, even though the heart of them is visual media. But in many arguably more important fields and more important kinds of publications, deep technical interactivity is what really matters. So this is an example. This is an interactive simulation of some complicated question in insurance law created by a computational lawyer. And it's interesting because the math is interesting. And this kind of interactivity really goes back to the roots of what Mathematica was designed for from the beginning, a place where experts who are not programmers could create and interact with the math of their problems without needing programmers to help them implement the interactivity. And now that electronic books are kind of finally here after decades of making sense but not really being there, the challenge is not just to solve the problem of electronic book distribution, but also to solve the problems of real serious interactivity in these electronic publications. One thing we've done is create a thing called computable document format, which is a packaging of Mathematica technology to enable meaningful mathematical interactivity in technical documents. As a way to let subject matter experts do this kind of thing. It uses the full power of Mathematica to deploy these sorts of complicated simulations and deep math to anyone's computer with a free reader on a wide range of devices. So people are using CDF and Mathematica to do interactive diagrams and applets and blogs and distribute it as standalone files with readers for desktop devices, mobile devices. It's a free reader, and the authoring environment is Mathematica, which many technical experts are proficient in. It's being used in textbooks in important ways, entire calculus textbooks, more than one of them now, based entirely on Mathematica CDF documents, and filled with literally hundreds and hundreds of interactive diagrams, which makes them far more useful than static books. What's really most important about this is that it allows the people who are experts in something other than programming to create meaningful interactivity without needing a team of programmers, which is too expensive for most of the kinds of technical publications that this is useful for. So Now that these kind of electronic documents are finally really being used very widely, we feel it's very important to encourage them to include not sort of meaningless interactivity, but real serious interactivity, which requires a powerful tool. And I hope I've communicated something about the importance of doing that. If you're interested, please visit the website or talk to me after the talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Theo. Next up, we've got Andrew Brenneman from Finitiv. And here's Andrew, and he's going to be talking about the cloud.
First, I want to change gears here. I know we're all excited about digital opportunities, and it is exciting, but most of our revenue is going to be coming from print and physical objects, and that means forklifts. And many of these devices and conveyances require OSHA certification. The fact that many publishers don't know that is a serious oversight and could lead to some significant legal and financial ramifications. I think that the... well, that didn't go so well. So I don't think I want to talk about forklifts anymore because that really sucked. I'd rather talk about something else, and that is pain. As an industry, we're executing unprecedented transformation, unprecedented change. And usually, the level of change it relates to the degree of pain. The problem with big changes are that we often need a lot of time to execute that change, but we have an inability to see the changes coming up. So this contradiction between these two forces is a very difficult challenge. And that's really the paradox of publishing today. We're laying railroad track, but we can't see where we're going. We can't see through the woods. We need to move toward fundamental transformation, but we don't have the vaguest idea about where we're going to get to when we end up there. So that we don't go broke or go insane, we have a recipe for sanity and success that we call cloud-based structured publishing. And it's real simple, and I want to run through it right now. And there are four parts of it. The first is defining standards. You've heard this from Sourcebooks. You've heard this from Hachette. You've heard this from X-Styles. Define your standards. That means define the standards in your manuscript, your word styles. Define your standards of your output, your InDesign templates and CSS. And then look for automation. You can't automate anything. This is a human-driven industry and process, but we should seek opportunities for automation based on those standards. Standards lead to automation and efficiencies. You should look for that in your process. Third, develop skills within the organization. Excellent presentation earlier from Hachette about bringing parts of the production process back inside. We need to start thinking about people as a strategic resource and getting them trained and having new skill sets. And finally, cloud services, the fourth piece. What is it? Externally managed platforms, usually with a browser interface, managed by a third party and typically paid for on a subscription basis or usage basis. And this is a significant piece of success. Why? Well, two important reasons. Neither of them had anything to do with HTML or technology. Capital preservation, that's money, and maintaining flexibility, your ability to control and course correct your strategy. Capital preservation. Technology is a really, really bad investment. The main reason is your technology platform will probably be obsolete before you reach ROI. That wasn't the case 5 years ago. It is now. It's a very tough business case to make to management. What cloud providers are shared service providers, just like printers, like Quad and Donnelly. They are demand aggregators that can drive throughput and pay off the platform in a way that individual companies cannot. Maintaining flexibility. What the governor wanted to say was that giving customers choice drives a meritocracy in a service economy, and that's a good thing. That allows you to change your mind and switch cloud providers more quickly than you can switch platforms. What kind of cloud services do publishers have? Well, they're kind of two categories. You can slice this any way you want. I slice it this way. Production clouds and delivery clouds. Production dealing with workflow, asset management, composition, translation, etc., and delivery, getting it to the end user. Lots and lots of cloud offerings out there. And they span the spectrum from production to delivery, usually a little bit of both. and they're critical to defining an economically valid publishing strategy. Finitive started in 2008 delivering services to publishers for digital success. Initially, that was in the form of creating strategic roadmaps. Increasingly, that got into technology services and program management. And now we're bringing it together in offering cloud solutions, because this is the way to go. Finitive PCS is the publisher's cloud suite. Instead of being controlled by channel providers, it is going to be a cloud that is run by the publisher. PCS Works essentially is a production cloud. PCS Beacon is a delivery cloud. Cloud delivery is really important because from one place, you can deliver dynamically to heterogeneous mobile and web applications. That's really cool. And also manage your analytics, looking at how people use your content in a centralized way. If you don't have access to well-structured content assets on cloud platforms, then you'll likely become subservient to other entities that do have that. Who said that? I said that. And I want you to remember that. Finally, it's not just Kool-Aid. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Eat the cotton candy, which is the sweet cloud of success, and take control of your digital destiny. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Andrew. Next up, we've got Maral Sattar from BiblioCrunch, who's one of two of our presenters who actually won our startup showcase at TOC in February this year. Welcome, Maral.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maral Sattar, and I'm the founder and CEO of BiblioCrunch, and I'm going to talk about how the publishing industry is like the Game of Thrones. So for those of you who are not familiar with the Game of Thrones, it's a HBO show based on a fantasy fiction series by G.R.R. Martin. It's got a huge cult following. I'm a passionate fan. It's got tons of fans all around the world. And it's based on a mythical kingdom of Westeros, which is a continent of seven kingdoms ruled by an Iron Throne. And there's threats that they fight, and there's Nightwalkers, there's creepy crawlers. And what happens in the Game of Thrones is the old world order comes to an end, the king of the Iron Throne is killed, a well-loved leader is executed, and war starts. And then various houses vie for kingship in their own fiefdoms. So basically, in Game of Thrones, you have several houses, which is a struggle between powerful families. You have marriage alliances between various houses. Partnerships are constantly changing, and people are always trying to look for ways to dominate. So the war between the Game of Thrones houses is like the war between the players and the publishing industry. Everyone's trying to figure out how to succeed and how to overcome the obstacles and how to deal with change that's coming. And a lot of them realize that change is here. So we have a bunch of characters. So we have Apple versus Amazon. We have Barnes & Noble. We have traditional publishers. And then we have publishing startups, who are kind of like some of the key players in the industry. And then we have the key players in Game of Thrones. So traditional publishers are like King Baratheon. So if you're familiar with the series, he used to be powerful. He was one of the original gatekeepers. He was late to adapting to change. And then the lack of innovation and led him to extinction, and he got killed in the end. Apple is kind of like Daenerys Targaryen. She rose from the ashes. She has an element of magic, and she has a huge cult-like following, kind of like Apple does, and Apple did. And then we have Renly Baratheon, who's kind of like Barnes & Nobles. He made a powerful marriage alliance with a powerful house, Marjorie Tyrell, similar to how Nook and Windows did, and they're kind of looking for glory. And then we have Amazon, kind of like Cersei Lannister, if you know her. She's kind of like the evil vixen. She's wealthy and powerful. Everyone loves to hate her, and she kind of plays by her own rules, but she has all the wealth and all the money, and has the ears of people. Now you have publishing startups, kind of like Jon Snow. He's sexy. He thinks outside of the box. He realizes what needs to be done to survive, and he kind of forms alliances and comes up with new ideas. So why do we need more publishing startups? Why do we need more Jon Snows? because entrepreneurs are passionate about the struggling industry. Their strategies are nimble, they're able to adapt really quickly, and they don't really favor particular publishing houses. They're kind of looking out for everyone. So the company that I started, called BiblioCrunch, can help the publishing industry because change is already here. So we connect passionate ebook professionals from around the world to create exceptional books. And then we also have a set of tools. So what can you do on BiblioCrunch? You have an e-publishing need. You need a cover design. You need something converted. You can launch your project. You could set your budget. And then you can hire a vetted professional. You could check out what their portfolio looks like and takes care of the payment processing system. And this is just a screenshot. It's very basic. It's very simple and easy to use. You could search projects, find a freelancer, post a project, and kind of refine on what your needs are for your publishing company. And we kind of help you with the entire publishing process. We have helpful, handy things like checklists, which kind of tells you everything that you need to know, like do you need enhanced features, do you need formatting, do you need editing, what kind of pricing do you need, and then every author and every publisher, every professional is vetted on our platform, so you know they're good. You can check in because they're hooked into LinkedIn, you could see their Twitter, and you can kind of see the reviews that people have written about them. So the outcome of Game of Thrones is yet to be determined. We don't know what's going to happen yet. But for publishers, we can actually write our own destiny because we have the technology tools and we can leverage them to kind of make it great. So join us. We're over 500 ebook professionals. We're going strong and going. And give us a spin, give us a run, and check us out on bibliocrunch.com. And we're also on Facebook and we're also on Twitter. Thank you.
Oh, golly. Thank you guys for sticking around. I promise it's almost over, but the next two are really good, so you'll be happy. Caleb Mason is up next, and I'm just going to take this time to get his PowerPoint going here.
Okay, thank you everybody for waiting. My name is Caleb Mason, and I am the founder of a new ebook publisher called Publirati. And my title is A Better Way to Launch New Fiction Writers or The Long Strange Trip of a Business Masochist. So I began back in the 80s in book selling and book publishing, and I had quite a bit of experience there. And the parties back in the 80s were great. It's true what you've heard. If you weren't there, it was a wonderful time to be in book publishing. But alas, all parties must end. And I left in 1989 for the world of analog photography and went right into the death of the 35-millimeter film industry. And it was a really tough time. I think it's similar to what's going on in book publishing right now. You had a new opportunity with digital, but you had the foundation of these large margin products, film, camera, single-use camera, collapsing rapidly. And the change was fast. But I managed to escape just in time to go into software publishing and technology in the 1990s, which was a great time. And the parties were fabulous. I remember Bill Gates spending $1.5 million on a fireworks show in San Diego. And it was just a fun time to be in technology. But alas, I ran into Google. And the company I worked for was making digital maps, and Google started giving away for free what we had been paid for and spent a lot of money in developing. So I was kind of at my wit's end. So just when I thought I'd hit the bottom, my new street buddy Ray didn't laugh at my crazy publishing idea. And as you can see from Ray's cartoon, he's a pretty smart businessman. Which brings us to today. So Publirati started with an amazing iPad reading experience. The sepia background, the large fonts, the no spine to wrestle with. Not stuffing a big book on a plane. It was just all too powerful to deny. One of the most amazing new things I had seen. And also a question, you know, how many good fiction writers are there out there who just can't get a start? You know, how many rejections from literary agents can you take? How many publishers can tell you there's not a market anymore for quality fiction? And more questions. Does anyone read literary fiction and short story collections anymore? Most of the talk here today has been about making money and about technology, which I find interesting. But what about the books? And where can you get lips like those in modern times? So why do books cost so much? In the time I was gone from publishing, hardcovers went to $29.95 and trade paperbacks went to $20. You know, how come Hollywood can make a movie that costs $7? And seriously, not even your own mother's going to pay $29.95 to read your first scatological novel. It's just not going to happen. So I went looking for some books to see what was out there. So the idea of Pablorati, and I narrowed it in but testing over time, was can I find good new literary fiction writers and publish their books at $2.99 and build an audience for them and then also represent them as an agent and sell them where it makes sense? You know, to create this highly selective brand. So the idea is these unknown writers have no brand. So create a brand behind them that can carry them as a collective and move forward in a different way, because the current way is broken. So I want you to meet two of my first authors. They both teach creative writing, one in India and one at Colby College in Maine. They're great people. They've been rejected so many times. They've been published in the New York Times. They've been published in Penguin in India, but they're out of options. So the first thing was to create that coherent brand, and so I want you to meet the brand, which is Pablorati, that's behind these novelists. All the jackets hang together. There is a look, there's a feel, there's a style. They don't look like all the other book jackets you see out there. So one question is, will the future see more e-books and fewer print titles? I totally believe this is going to happen, and I actually think independent bookstores are going to be the last ones standing when we see the wipeout of the superstores. It's just going to have to happen. And I want you to pay attention to the publishers, to the painful Kodak lesson. You know, Kodak moved pretty well into digital photography, but they didn't get rid of all that old cost fast enough to survive. And I hate to stand here and say that need to be more cuts, but I think they're going to be publishers are going to be replaced. So my message is the threats are the opportunities, and so it's important to get back to being a publisher, doing what publishers do well, acquire new writers, launch their careers, and not always think just about money, but maybe think about something else. So thank you very much. I hope you'll come visit my website, and it's been fun. Thank you for hanging out.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've got one more, and it's Kathy from Bubblish. Well, actually, I shouldn't say from Bubblish. You've got a whole other company. But Kathy, come on up, and I'm going to spend... Oh, I've got you all here. So Kathy's actually got her partner here, Charles, and they're going to talk a little bit about a brand new product that they're unveiling today. And it's a very exciting marketing product. So welcome to Kathy and Charles from Bubblish.
Thank you.
Okay, when you're ready, we go. We're just going to go straight. Okay. And we're off.
Hi, I'm Kathy Meiss. I'm the president and founder of Bubblish, and I've been a writer and editor for 20 years, and I was the founding editor of Forbes Media Critic, and I drink a huge amount of coffee.
And I'm Charles Wagsmith. I'm CEO of Bubblish, and I develop SaaS applications, write books about HTML and CSS3, and play the guitar.
As you know, discoverability is the issue for authors and publishers and readers. Each year, more and more books are published, and that trend will only increase. Content abundance is wonderful, but, you know, it's only if you can find the things you want.
We've heard a lot today about the disrupted marketplace. So with fewer gatekeepers, there's a massive online marketplace where books, video, and music are relentlessly colliding.
Of course, with disruption comes opportunity. Authors and publishers now have unprecedented access to their readers. And cross-media opportunities for content, well, they offer additional revenue streams for authors and publishers.
The challenge is for authors and publishers to find effective marketing tools that focus the conversation on content and build loyal audiences and drive sales.
Relationships are the content, the context for discovery in today's increasingly social world. Shares, likes, retweets. This is word of mouth magnified, and this has always been a great and powerful way to sell books.
The true beneficiaries of social discovery are the authors, who can now create direct and enduring relationships with their readers and build their audience. But to have effective social conversations, authors need tools to help them.
And that is why we created Bubblish. the social book discovery platform that will revolutionize the way that writers share their stories and readers find the books and authors they'll love. Publish will connect writers and readers through a new form of social storytelling.
Publish brings together the very best aspects of today's social web: the visual interest of Pinterest, highly shareable content of Twitter, the successful social commerce of Fab, and the back-end intelligence of Pandora.
This is the world's first book bubble. You'll see an excerpt as well as an author insight. We call this the story behind the story. We designed book bubbles to capture the essence of that quiet bookstore discovery experience that everyone is missing.
So to create a bubble, you highlight an excerpt of your uploaded book, add your author insight, the story behind the story, and share your bubble across multiple social networks.
What powers the magic of Publish is layers of social metadata created by the writers and readers. Authors not only select a genre for the books that they upload, but they add keywords to describe unique aspects of their work.
The readers also add social metadata through multiple genres and keywords they provide, and through their actions as they browse the bubble stream.
So imagine a discovery system that can map all this social metadata to match readers with authors and books that they'll love, no matter what the subject: Steve Jobs, zombies, Tokyo, or Steve Jobs dining with zombies in Tokyo. We can find it for you.
Publish is going to help authors and writers find an audience who will buy their book and support them throughout their career. Publish will help readers find new authors in genres they love to read.
And we have really big plans for the Publish community. Think of online events with personal invites to those writers, and they can give them right to those most supportive readers. Think webinars to show how to best market your book online successfully. Think book clubs. And we also think the Publish logo makes a great T-shirt.
So consumers want multiple devices and to access their content everywhere. Publishers want standardization and their deserved share of financial control. And the answer is open source solutions such as HTML5 and direct-to-consumer cloud-based delivery.
So we are honored to use this Ignite BEA event to officially launch Publish. Charles?
Indeed. And I have on the phone here our team in Argentina who are actually going to fire up Publish right at this moment. So I am going to speak to them and ask them to flip the switch, and they can hear me right now. So here we go. Five, four,
come on, everyone.
Three, two, one. Okay, let's go. And now Publish is officially open for the world to come
live
and bubble.
So come and visit us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat.
Enjoy your evening, and thanks for staying for the end of this.
Oh, yeah, Publish.com. You can go there tonight and check it out.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. That's cool. Thank you guys for sticking around. I want to just say thank you very much, IDPF, for hosting this. It's really important to be supportive of startups that are working so hard to keep the written word, whatever it becomes, alive. And thank all of our speakers for Ignite. And I want to say that everybody, all of you guys did an awesome job under very hard circumstances, and you'll all be receiving a prize from O'Reilly. So good job. And thanks all. Go out and have fun partying at BEA Monday night.